Christopher Luscombe is back at the Globe following his successful production of The Comedy of Errors here in 2006. He's directing The Merry Wives of Windsor for the Totus Mundus season. Although now well established as a director, he's also a writer and actor, having himself played a number of Shakespearean roles, including Gobbo and Dogberry. My name is Heather Neal, and I'm at the Globe now with Christopher Luscombe so that he can tell Theatre Voice something about his plans for Sir John Falstaff and the Merry Wives of Windsor, a play traditionally thought to have been commissioned by Elizabeth I herself after she'd enjoyed watching the Fat Knight and his comic activities in Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2. In fact, the play may have been written simply to cash in on the box office success of the histories, or part of it may have featured as a mask entertainment at a ceremony for Knights of the Order of the Garter. Whatever its origins, this is Shakespeare's only bourgeois, only wholly English comedy. Is its glimpse into ordinary provincial Elizabethan life one of its attractions for you, Chris?
I think it is, really. It's so unusual to work on a play by Shakespeare about his own world. We always seem to be dealing with exotic foreign climes, don't we, and lords and ladies and aristocracy, and this is very much about the class that Shakespeare grew up in. The middle classes. It could really be Stratford. When we were researching the play, I went with the designer to Windsor and to Stratford, and you just felt that he was holding the mirror up to his own world when he wrote this play. It's about the bourgeois, comfortable, slightly complacent middle classes. So I think, yes, we've all enjoyed that, because it's a world, of course, we all recognise. When we went to Windsor, you could see Alice and Frank and George and Meg, all the characters from Merry Wives, they're all still there, really. They're just wearing modern clothes.
Yes, well, having said that, one of the themes is class. Falstaff obviously thinks of himself as superior to these provincials, doesn't he? And we very much enjoy seeing him get the better of by them.
Yes, he brings with him not only class, but also a whiff of the city. He comes from London with his cronies. And I think that the people of Windsor are really unsettled by him, really scared of him. He's glamorous and has very high status, but he's treacherous, and they want to maintain the status quo. And I think it is about the upper classes and them being different and foreign and scary. The play actually has some almost representative members of every class in it, and we were very particular about who belongs where and what everyone's relative status is.
Well, the beginning of the play is quite difficult. The language is hard for a modern audience, and it's mainly in prose. It sounds very much like Shakespeare may have spoken in the street rather than when he was being a poet. So you've got to get the audience's attention straight away. Is that something you've been working on?
It is a bit of a problem, because the first scene is particularly difficult, rather like Comedy of Errors, which has that long exposition scene at the beginning, which is difficult and serious and quite a convoluted story that you have to get across. In this, there's a lot of plot set up, which is quite difficult language, as you say. And I've done a lot of trimming and really tried to grapple with the first scene, really tried to find the best way of telling the story. We grab them with, of course, you don't have house lights going down here or stage lights coming up. It's all in the open air and bright. So we use music to focus and really working with the actors to create a way of speaking which is completely natural and normal and not heightened and not actorish or histrionic, just something which is very recognisably middle class and normal. The play is often called his sitcom, and I think it can sound a bit of a glib comment, really, but I actually do think that it is like sitcom. I mean, if one thinks of the good sitcoms, the great sitcoms, there's nothing to be ashamed of in comparing it. And we've talked a lot about, there's a lot that are reflected in this play. You feel, I mean, there's a lot of similarities between the plot of Merry Wives and 40 Towers. And a lot of the characters, there are parallels. So you can think of the really great sitcoms and think, well, how are they constructed, and how can they inform what we do? What could we learn from them? So I think that provides us with a springboard as to how to approach the play.
But you're setting it as Elizabethan, aren't you? And I think you may be going to build the stage out. Can you tell us anything about what it's going to look like?
We're doing Elizabethan because the chap who runs the Globe, when he asked me to do the play, Dominic Drumgall, he said he'd be grateful if I did it Elizabethan, partly because it's the first time Merriwives has been done at the Globe. So it's quite nice to do it in its own period the first time. And also because a lot of the audience really liked that. And I think that's fair enough. And I think that it's important to run with the building rather than fight the building. And it's such a, architecturally, such a strong statement. There it is sitting there. The Globe sort of is the star of the show, really, isn't it? And I wanted the audience to feel that the Globe is the set. We're in Elizabethan Windsor. And I have built the set out, the stage out. The designer, Janet Bird, has come up with this absolutely brilliant design. I think it's brilliant. I'm always very wary about using the yard at the Globe. I think you can lose focus, partly because if you get actually down there amongst the audience, you disappear. So we've got these walkways that go out into the audience, and I've seen that done up to a point before, but these are slightly different walkways. And they provide a sort of a kind of almost like a not a ball ring, but a walkway that goes right the way round, and you could walk up one end of the stage and then come round and come back on the other side, and it means that it just gives us all kinds of different locations, different kinds of angles of where the actors can project towards, and it means that if you're in the seats that get wrapped around the stage, you don't, I think, feel that you're the poor relation. You're a bit, you've got a really good angle on a lot of stuff, so I'm really pleased with that.
That does sound like an advantage. Well, we said the language is very difficult at the beginning, but one of the subjects of the play is language, isn't it? The English language particularly, and how it is used by various people.
Yes, he's brilliant on the way different people speak, isn't he? He's very particular. I mean, you could cover up the margin of the page and who's saying the lines, you can guess immediately from the words who's speaking.
Especially Parson Evans, the Welshman, whose every B is a P. That's right.
But actually, when I was editing the script and sort of working out our playing version, I went through it and I took out all the funny spellings because I thought that it would be quite good to get a real Welsh actor to do it in a real Welsh accent rather than a sort of Shakespeare's own estimation of what Welsh accents were like in the 16th century. He's doing, the actor Gareth Armstrong is from Swansea and is doing a brilliant performance. But I love the way Shakespeare takes such delight in the way people use and abuse the English language, and that's referred to explicitly in the play, that the host talks about hacking the language, and some of the characters do exactly that. But to very comic effect, because it's all hilarious.
Yeah, well, you've got Falstaff. You've also got quite a few other characters that if people have seen the Henry IVs, they'll know, from Nim, Pistol, Bardolph, Mistress Quickly, Shallow.
Yeah.
And I suppose you could say that although the Welsh and French characters are very different, they echo the comedy of Llywelyn and the French court. So apart from those two, are obviously different. Are the ones who are reappearing around Falstaff, are they the same people, or do we not have to bother with that?
I think really we have to not bother with it. I think it's very, very odd. No one knows quite when he wrote the play, but we think it was probably between Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, somewhere in the middle there. When he was working on Part 2, he was probably writing Merriwives.
That would be about 1597.
Yeah, 1597, exactly. And I just don't understand why there's Mistress Quickly, who marries Pistol, doesn't she, in the Henry IV plays, and there's no reference to that whatsoever. She has run the pub in Eastcheap in the Henrys, and now is a housekeeper to a French doctor in Windsor. What was he playing at? We'll just never know what he meant by that. I think you have to just really judge them on what you get in the text of Merriwives. But it's fun to do the detective work and compare them with the other plays. I think I personally increasingly think the Falstaff is very close to the Falstaff of Henry IV Part 1. Everyone always says it isn't and that it's a totally different man, but I don't think that's true. There's lots of parallels. You miss perhaps the gravity and the philosophy of Henry IV, But the sense of fun and the jokey prankster chap, that is absolutely the same man. So I think, you know, you...
And his vanity.
And the vanity, absolutely, yeah. There's lots of things that we found. He uses a lot of the same language, but... for anyone who loves Shakespeare, it's intriguing to work with these characters. And Shallow, of course, is a sort of skittish comic version, differently comic version of the one who we had in the end of the fourth plays. Yeah. But
he couldn't be the same without Silence.
Well, absolutely no. And Nim and Pistol and Bodolf, I've always find them particularly tricky characters to get my head around, really. And I have done a very bold thing. I've actually got rid of Bardolph, because we only have 17 actors in the company, and so there was no way, unless we got into ridiculous doubling, that I could quite achieve Bardolph. I thought someone's got to go, and I think it might as well be him. And it puts a greater focus on Nim and Pistol, and I've managed to reallocate some of the lines so they get slightly better material. And I think it makes them stronger characters as a result.
Well, it's a play that needs lots of children as well, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's
because because you have Parthen Evans's class, and you also have the fairies in the mask at the
that's
end.
Right.
So are you actually going to use children and have lots of different ones?
Yes, we have two different teams. There's Robin as well, Falstaff's Paige,
yeah.
And that's quite a good part, actually. That's really, you know, he has quite a lot to say. But we had so many auditions for children, and we've ended up with a really sweet little group of lovely kids. I kept it as tight and small and minimal as I could, really, because I thought it was partly because of expense. You know, you have to consider all these things. But so, in other words, there are five children in every performance, but we have two teams, so 10 children in all that we've split it up with.
Mm.
But they're doing very well and working very hard, and the little guys who are playing Robin, actually, the two of them, they're splendid. They really are like, you know, professionals. They fit in very well, and everyone is very fond of them.
Well, you mentioned expense just now. Money is an important theme, isn't it? Because Falstaff is not Falstaff in love, as Elizabeth is supposed to have requested. He's really more interested in getting the cash, which he's hoping to winkle out of the husbands of the merry wives he's pretending to woo. So have you talked about money a lot in rehearsal?
We have, because there are so many references to cash, aren't there, in the play? And of course it's a very recognisable thing, isn't it? From our own society, we're all obsessed by money, and I suppose that's what made the middle class, the emerging middle classes at the time, they were in a phenomenon of that period, weren't they? And a new phenomenon, and money is what obsesses them all. But I was quite interested in the fact that I'd always gone along with this idea that Falstaff is just after the money. And what I think terrific about the way Chris Benjamin plays Falstaff is that you feel he is also crazy about the wives. I think the money is the main thing, but he loves wooing these two women and chasing them. He thinks they're terrific. And I don't think I've ever really quite seen that in Falstaff before.
He is quite complimentary about Mistress Ford as someone who might be fun.
Exactly.
He?
And, of course, they would be fun. They are the Merry Wives. They are tremendously good company, you know, and probably very attractive in their own way. So certainly they are in our production. So I think I quite like that it's not just a cynical move to get the cash, although that is paramount, but it's also going to be a great deal of fun along the way. And that's important.
Well, less familiar to us is another theme, which is humours and the satire on the humours which were being written about by other writers at the time. Do we have to sort of just regard most of those as malapropisms when they're referred to, or because Mistress Quickly sometimes uses the wrong word, doesn't she?
Yes.
And it's not going to be very clear to us, is it, as we're watching?
I don't think it is, really, because it's just not something that we know about now, is it? And I think we probably just take Mrs. Quickly's malapropisms as just funny use of the language. He loves that, doesn't he? A lot of his characters do that. I'm thinking of Dogberry, you know, and others too. Elbow does it, doesn't he, I think. And Mrs. Quickly has some terrific language. I think she's a very, very wonderfully written part for a slightly older lady. I mean, it reminds me of the nurse in in Romeo, really. I think those wonderful arias she has, they really are a joy. They're almost like a sort of Shakespearean Alan Bennett, the way she, the sort of gossipy nature of it all, the tittle-tattle, this sort of verbal diarrhea is fantastic. And it very well served up by Sue Wallace in the role. I think probably it's there just to be enjoyed now as a character thing. Nim has endless references to humour, the humours. I've actually lost a lot of those because I think it's a joke which goes over everybody's head. I haven't found anyone who actually understands that joke, so I decided that there was no point in banging on if the audience weren't going to be getting it. In a way, you mentioned jealousy. I'm interested in that because, of course, the play is a comic take on jealousy.
Mm. Yes, Ford is a sort of precursor of Othello and Leontes, isn't it? It's a wonderful picture of manic behaviour, and which drives him to disguise himself in some of the funniest scenes and actually go to Falstaff to ask his help.
Yes, exactly.
When he thinks that Falstaff is going to be cuckolding him.
Yes, it relates, I think, very closely to Othello, because, as in Othello, this poor man has such good evidence for thinking his wife's been unfaithful. With Leontes, it's irrational, isn't it? Or,
yes.
I mean, people have written essays about why Leontes does what he does, but it seems to be pretty irrational. It's just a sort of a moment of madness. In this play, and in Othello, he has the evidence staring him in the face, and as we've worked on it, you just feel so sorry for Ford, because he brings it all on himself. He's jealous by nature, obviously, but he does have his jealousy fueled by the people around him, and he works himself into this terrible frenzy. I mean, that's why I think I mentioned Fawlty Towers earlier, because it reminds one of the Basil Fawlty rants, which are all based on a sort of wonderful chain of events that have a wonderful logic. I suppose all farce depends, doesn't it, on absolutely rock-solid logic. And you see it escalating through the course of the play. And I hope the audience will really follow that through. I really want that to be absolutely clear, what just in terms of storytelling, really.
Well, eventually the wives take the husbands into their confidence. So do you think Ford is changed by this experience? Has he learned now about to trust his wife?
Oh, without a doubt. There's really good evidence in the text to suggest that he's a changed man. And I'd like to feel that when the play is over, their marriage is going to be a happy one. It's quite significant to think that they don't have children. They're held up against the pages, who seem to be a bit of a golden couple. They have a son and a daughter. It seems to be a sort of model family. And there's the Fords, who are unhappy together, and she talks very openly about his jealousy and how miserable he is and untrusting. And I believe that after the play, they're going to settle down and have a great time together. I hope so.
Well, it's another strand in the plot, of course, is Anne Page getting off with the man that she wants, not any of the people that other people are deciding she should marry. And that all happens at the end, which, in a sort of strange, mystical episode, which is very funny, but also can be quite magical, can't it, in the forest?
Yes. Yes, it is. I slightly resisted the idea that it was magical at first, because I thought that actually it's just people doing amateur dramatics in the forest, putting on silly costumes and pretending to be fairies. But actually, as we've worked in it, But even in the community of Windsor at the time, they are talking about Herne the Hunter as a legend. This is a subject for play acting. But I've increasingly felt that for Shakespeare, going into the wood, leaving the town, going into the wood is a, as in Midsummer Night's Dream or As You Like It, there's something magical and transforming about it.
Yeah.
And something does happen, even though they're wearing silly costumes and it's all very homemade and makeshift. Something takes over to do with the night. It's the nighttime, it's the forest, and they emerge at the end transformed, and they go, and there's a line at the end about going back into town to discuss and laugh about what they've been through. I hope there is something which is intangible at the end, but is magical and transforming. Yes.
Has Falstaff learned his lesson too? will he ever?
Will he ever? I can't think he ever really will. But he certainly seems to be accepted by Windsor at the end. And I think he wouldn't try it on with the wives anymore. I think he's gone as far as he can go with them.
Yes.
I've tried to suggest that he can become a friend at the end. He's not threatening, and they welcome him with open arms.
Mm.
Yeah.
Although he's left. Well, he's not. Taken into the coupledom that is sort of happens all over the rest of the stage, isn't it?
No, that's a very good point. Because in fact, when I was working out the curtain call, which I wanted to base on couples, because it seems to be a play about couples, and even Caius and Senda end up with a partner, even though it's a great lovely boy. I did want to suggest that that Falstaff is the exception that proves the rule, and so in fact. Poor old Chris Benjamin has no one to dance with at the end. But he makes up for that by dancing with his little page. But he doesn't have a partner in that way.
Mm.
He is isolated in a sense. Yeah.
But not to the extent of it being at all melancholy at the end.
I suppose it's a little bit bittersweet, maybe. I mean, I quite like that, and I think that's very
Well, he does have to be seen to have been taught a lesson by these people.
He does. He certainly, they do treat him pretty badly in the forest. I think I felt that if they're going to put him through that, having done that, rather like you perhaps when you reprimand a child, you then have to say, but we do love you after all, and you know it's okay, we've taught you a lesson and now we want to say that we love you. So I hope that that's what comes across in the play. There's forgiveness.
I think that's a very good note on which to end. Thanks very much, Christopher.